الله أكبر الله أكبر الله أكبر الله
of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the universe. I greet you with the greetings of all the prophets, from Adam to Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be upon you. Today we continue with our fourth program in the series of Muslim beliefs. Today's topic is the continuation of our program last week, where we discussed magic, the unseen, and some related topics. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid. My guest on today's program is Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Welcome to Islam in Focus, Brother Jamal. Could you perhaps summarize last week's program, when we the first program we began talking about this question of magic?
Magic, okay. We started first by explaining the various meanings of magic, and we said that magic could mean simply enchantment or attraction. It could also mean playing a little trick, just like bringing a rabbit out of a hat or something of that sort, which is okay if used just for entertainment. But we talked about another type of tricks which are used to strike terror in people's heart or exploit them. We gave example from the Quran about the magicians during the time of Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, how they tried to deceive people. Of course, Moses was not a magician. We should make it clear that when he threw his staff, it became a real snake and swallowed all the trivial magical deeds or deceptions that the magicians were using to prove his prophethood. But we also talked about another meaning of magic, and that is the sense of sorcery, or using various magic or witchcraft or wizardry to hurt some people for sinister and bad purpose. And we indicated that Islam is very clear on the question of magic, that Islam forbade the use of magic, the learning of magic, or even resorting or going to some magician to help in solving any particular problem. Actually, we indicated that if whenever the person is faced with a problem, Muslims should depend upon God. He should realize that only the final authority lies in his hand. He should use his God-given rationality and mind, the help of others and advice to solve his problem. And after all, of course, he has to constantly petition God and pray to him for guidance. Then we touched on a related subject. That's the question of divination. People who claim to foretell the future, the fortune tellers. And again, we said that Islam has forbid that the knowledge of the unseen is only, or does belong only to God, and that with the exception of what He, God Himself, reveals to some people, to some prophets, for example, or messengers, that nobody has access to this knowledge of the unseen. And we indicated that this basic principle applies to all other forms of telling the future, whether it's palm reading or astrology or horoscope, that all of these things are at times exploitation, really, of people. We indicated whenever the Quran mentioned anything about the stars, it doesn't talk about it in terms of fortune telling, but as beautification in the sky, as light, as guidance for the travelers.
Okay, well, to continue our discussion on this issue of the unseen, I'm curious to know if there are specific areas of the unseen or specific things about the future which Islam emphasizes are particularly that Islam emphasizes that particularly belong to God or to Allah.
There are five areas that are summarized actually in one verse in the Quran, and also repeated in one of the saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. That appears in chapter 31, verse 34. Maybe I can just read it for you. It says, verily, the knowledge of the hour, that is the day of judgment, is with God alone. It is He who sends down rain, and He who knows what is in the wombs. No one knows what it is that he will or she will earn tomorrow, nor does anyone know in what land he or she is to die. Verily, with God is full knowledge, and He's acquainted with all things. In other words, there are five basic areas that are emphasized in this passage in the Quran.
Mm-hmm.
The knowledge, first, of the hour, the day of judgment, knowledge of the rainfall,
mm-hmm.
What is in the wombs of mothers, what the person is going to earn in the following day, and where and how the person is going to die.
Some people might argue, though, given the areas that we just mentioned, that these things are things that can be, like, for example, rainfall can be predicted by a forecast. Other things you mentioned might be able to be detected by scientific means. What would be your response to people who would take that line?
I think in raising this argument, there seems to be mixing between two things. Mixing between the absolute and complete certain knowledge of God, which is with complete certitude, without any doubt about its exactitude, and the human effort to try and predict and forecast something that may happen on the basis of some partial evidence that is available to us. Let's take each of these five areas briefly, just to make sure. First of all, I don't think that people who raise this argument raise any question about the hour, that's the day of judgment,
mm-hmm.
when exactly it's going to happen. There may be signs of the approaching of the day of judgment or big havoc in the universe, but nobody can say for sure when. Today, I think this probably should be out of that. The second issue, the question of rainfall. When the weatherman or weather person makes any forecast about rainfall, it is based on certain information about certain study of the patterns of wind, the speed, direction, the clouds. This has been facilitated with information that could be obtained by satellites. So you're not really getting knowledge of the hidden things. They are things that God has created already in the universe. Things which already started by way of wind moving according to certain laws which got created in nature. In that sense, it's not really encroachment on the domain of God to make this kind of forecast, because God, according to the Quran, encourages us to try and learn what is there in the universe and to harness this for human benefit. The third issue about the knowledge of what is in the wombs of mothers.
Mm-hmm.
Some people would say, all right, that means or refers perhaps to the sex of the fetus. And say, all right, we can use some medical means now. I think there's like taking some of the fluid from the uterus and analyze that and come up with some projection or forecast of the sex of the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
But what is forgotten here is that the verse that I cited in the Quran did not say the sex of the fetus. It simply says only God knows what is in the wombs. What is in the womb is not necessarily whether the person is going to be male or female. What kind of person? What kind of character? How long he or she is going to live?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of destiny that the person will have even after death? So this is a very all embraceive knowledge that, again, only God would know for sure and in full details. In the fourth area, when it says that no person knows for sure what he or she is going to earn tomorrow, it doesn't mean earn salary, because you say, right, I'm working on a fixed salary, I know how much I'm going to make tomorrow.
Yes.
Earn here is used to earn everything, deeds. What kind of good or bad deeds you're going to earn in your tomorrow. And again, nobody can tell for sure, because nobody knows whether he would be alive tomorrow. And finally, in which land the person is going to die. And I think all of us attest to this fact that medical doctors can sometimes predict that this person may probably die within so many days or so many months, but the exact moment, the exact date, it's something that is reserved with the knowledge of God. So in other words, the main issue here is that distinction between the full certain knowledge that God knows exactly what exact moment things are going to take, and between God permitted forecast of certain natural phenomena, which according to the Quran takes a very very open attitude towards understanding of the universe and the various laws, because to the Muslim, those laws in the universe are created by God, and we have to understand them and harness them for our benefit.
I'd like to turn to another area now, and that's the aspect of knowledge of the future relating to dreams. Sometimes people have dreams which eventually turn out to come true. Mm-hmm. Does that kind of a situation contradict the Islamic understanding about the unseen?
Not necessarily. This is one, again, I remind you of something that you mentioned also in the last program. Actually, it was one verse that we quoted from the Quran, that the knowledge of the unseen is reserved to God except as He permits. So there is a possibility there of God permitting or allowing some of this information or giving them to prophets, to messengers, or even to people through dreams. In fact, I find I have a reference to that particular point in one of the sayings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, which is narrated in Sahih Muslim, one of the authentic collections of prophetic sayings, in which the Prophet, peace be upon him, divides dreams into three types. Mm-hmm. He says there's a good dream, and that comes from God. Mm-hmm. There is a bad dream that comes from Satan or devils. And then there is the dream which is basically your own thoughts, something that emanates from your own mind or your own thoughts or worries. Now, as far as the first category, dreams that comes from God, this could be a kind of warning of something wrong that you might be tempted to do, so just give you some advance warning. It could be, like I said, even something of a foretelling of something that is going to happen to you very soon. This is coming from God. It could be like a gift of this one aspect of prophecy. In fact, in one saying of Prophet Muhammad, he says that if a person is gifted with these dreams that come true, that this dream, type of dream, constitute one out of 45 portions of prophecy, just like you said, about 2% or so of prophecy. You're not a prophet, but it's just one touch of this prophecy. So there's nothing wrong with this. The second type of dream, which the Prophet called dream from Satan, some evil suggestions or some scary things like nightmares, he said that this is from Satan. What to do? Again, he explained in the collection of Muslim variety of ways when this happens to you. If you wake up scared or with a bad dream, don't tell people about it. You could simply invoke the name of God. Say, I take refuge in the God, in the name of God, most beneficent, most merciful. One of the invocations that you could use. He also recommended that you change the side you're sleeping on. If you're sleeping on your right side, you turn on your left side, and vice versa. Still, even a better way is to rise up, make ablution, and perform prayers, Islamic prayers, and this will be explained later, and then go back to bed. This will drive away the evil spirits or these evil suggestions, and you can sleep again securely. The third type of dreams is something that many psychiatrists perhaps would be interested in. That's a reflection of some of your thoughts, your prior experience or knowledge or worries or desires or whatever the case may be. And this could be neutral. It may not necessarily cause any particular harm. It reflects your own thoughts. In fact, if I may add just one quick remark, that a dream, in the case of a prophet, accredited messenger or prophet of God, for him alone, it becomes compulsory. Whatever the prophet sees in his dream is regarded as a direct command of God to him, just as much as he sends the angel of revelation to instruct him to do certain things. We find evidence in the Quran about this in the story of Prophet Abraham when he was commanded by God in his dream to sacrifice or to offer for sacrifice his only son Ishmael. And I say Ishmael according to Muslim belief, because according to the Quran it was Ishmael. It's clearly implied in the Quran. And that story, for example, is found particularly in chapter 37, verses 100 through 113. But that's, again, something that applies exclusively to a prophet or messenger. And this, the era of prophethood ended with the last prophet, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him.
Let me ask a question of bad omens or bad luck. Does the holy book of the Muslims, the Quran, have anything to say about this?
There is a term which is used in the Quran which approximates the meaning of bad omen. It's called in Arabic tatayyur, which actually believing in that somebody or some person brings bad luck. We find this is quite common, and I was surprised to find that in varieties of cultures. For example, people having some hang up with the number 13.
Yes.
One time I heard that even when they build, some people when they build high-rises,
yes, they
you could go in the elevator, you have floor number 12 and then floor number 14, because 13, that's a no-no. You know,
yes.
People, for example, feeling bad luck if a black cat passes in front of you.
Right.
Or if you pass next to a ladder. Of course, that might be understandable because the ladder might fall on you.
Yes.
But they believe that that itself brings bad luck, regardless of what happened to you immediately at that time. Some people might have bad omen from certain objects or people they see or animals they encounter. The Quran indicates that in the past many people has fallen prey to this kind of superstition. It's not accepted to the Muslim. Indeed, the Quran mentioned by way of ridiculing some of the unbelievers who used to accuse the prophets in the past that the prophets brought bad luck to them. This accusation, for example, appears in chapter 36, verse 18 in the Quran, and it's denied that prophets do not really bring bad omen or bad luck. In the case of Prophet Saleh, one of the prophets of God, in chapter 27, verse 47, it also talks about accusation made against him. Even in the case of one of the great five prophets, Prophet Moses, peace be upon him, we find that his people, even the Egyptians at that time, felt that Prophet Moses and his followers brought bad luck to them. This would be interesting because, if I just may quote it, it's in chapter 7, verse 131. It talks about the Egyptians at that time. It says, when good times come, or came to them, they said, this is due to us.
Mm-hmm.
But when gripped by calamity, they ascribed it to evil omens connected with Moses and those with him.
Yes.
Behold, in truth, the omens of evil are theirs in God's sight, but most of them do not understand. In other words, Islam came to change the whole notion of bad omen, that bad omen is not necessarily just a superstitious belief that person or event bring bad luck, but what truly brings bad luck are the evil deeds of the person. And this is very essential because there are some sayings of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, when he uses that term, but he changes the direction altogether from believing in it as a superstition into some objective and rational evil. Like when you say, for example, a bad omen connected with the home, it could be just bad neighborhood, a bad neighbor, an omen involved in some animal that you use, like a horse, for example. It could be because it could be a troublesome type of animal if it's not, for example, behaving itself. So the whole meaning is changed from superstitious, supernatural belief to the actual reasons why, or a consort, or a spouse, for example. Not because of a mysterious thing about the spouse, but because, again, the spouse is the closest person with whom you live. And again, if the character of that person is not upright, it becomes bad in that sense, objectively and rationally, not mysteriously. It is not unusual indeed that because of some people's involvement in belief in bad omen, that they tend to become self-fulfilling prophecies. Somebody leaving home and say, oh my goodness, you know, a black cat passed in front of me while I'm getting to my car.
Or a crow.
Right. And then the person keeps thinking about that, all the anxiety that's aroused might lead him to have an accident on the way and say, oh, that was the crow that I saw in the morning. What does the crow have to do? It could be just self-fulfilling type of prophecy. That's why, indeed, the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, in one saying, he says, it is not of us, it's not a Muslim. He who believes in bad omen or goes to someone else who tells him about this omen, a person who practices divination or foretelling of the future or goes to someone who practices divination, a person who practices sorcery or even resort to someone who practices sorcery. All of these type of omens are included in this saying.
Well, you may have in part answered my next question. I was going to look at the other side of the coin with the opposite situation to bad omen and look to the situation of belief in charms and other things. A lot of people believe that some of these charms can protect them from evil. Certain things like rabbit feet bring them good luck and so on. What is the Muslim position on those kinds of... I think I already know the answer, but what's the Muslim position on that kind of thought?
Or people who use, for example, horseshoes in their own. It's very surprising that even among cultures where there's a high degree of education and rationality, that many of these things still persist. In some other places, they use like hanging a horn or hand or eye or something of that sort. Yeah. No, the basic rule in terms of these things is that it relates to one basic principle that we discussed in the last program, that this kind of belief reflects a belief in some other power beside the power of God, as a rival power or sharing in his divine attributes. And as such, it is just as rejected in Islam as bad omen is also rejected. Indeed, there are two sayings of Prophet Muhammad. One of them is narrated in Ahmad, in which he says, "Man allaqa faqad ashrak." A person who wears or have a necklace or something, hanging something, believing that this protects him, then he is really associating other deities or other powers with the power of God. In another saying in the collection of Tirmidhi, he says, "Man allaqa shay'an wukila ilay." A person who hangs up something, believing in its protection, God will leave him to that thing to protect him, which means, of course, that thing has no power to protect the individuals. So in that sense, it is out. For a true Muslim, he would not believe in that. It's unfortunate that you find some Muslims still hang this thing out of imitation to others. Even in the case of illness, for example, what Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, taught, and that I quote him again in saying narrated in Ahmad, he says, "Seek remedy for your disease, because he who created disease also created the cure for it." So one should not have a superstitious thought about either good or bad. I mean, one has to apply rational means and seek. Of course, this does not contradict beyond rationality the attitude of prayers to God, invocation of His name, and believe that God can cure you even without the agency of medicine. But what Islam provides is that you've got to try first, do your best, and then leave the rest to God. You should always feel that it is ultimately His authority. One of the interesting practices of the Prophet, peace be upon him, was when he visited somebody who's sick, he used to make something called ruqya. Ruqya means to make prayer for his cure. One of these reads like this: "أذهب الباس رب الناس اشفي أنت الشافي لا شفاء إلا شفاءك شفاء لا يغادر سقما." He puts his hand on the person's forehead and says, "Relieve the suffering, O Lord of mankind. Cure, you are the curer. There is no cure but yours, cure which leaves no trace of illness." But it does not say don't take medicine, in addition. to seeking the proper means. So this way you find that the attitude of Islam is to combine between rational ways of looking for good solutions to your problems, but in the meantime, always believing that everything is contingent on the power and will of God. There's no contradiction between these two.
In the 5 minutes or so that we have left remaining on the program, I want to pursue one more question in this particular one, and then perhaps move on to another area. I'm interested in your comments in the area of you've heard the expression oftentimes used, the bad eye. Mm-hmm. Or some people believe that some people who are envious can cause harm to a person. I suppose a related kind of thing might be voodoo, for example, where people put spells on people, that kind of thing.
Right.
What's your comment on that kind of...
Well, it reminds me with some friend that was telling me the other day that two people who are believed to have bad eyes, that whenever they look at someone or something, something bad happens to it. And they said one of them, they started competing, one of them looked at a mountain, and he looked at it and the mountain evaporated, dissipated.
Yes.
So the other person looked at him and said, "My goodness, what kind of an eye have you got?" And that other person became blind. Well, the question of envy has been mentioned in the Quran in more than one place, but perhaps more specifically in chapter 113, particularly verse 5, in which a believer is told to seek the refuge or protection of God from the evil of an envious person when he or she envies. Now, what exactly is the bad eye or spell? One possibility when you approach it would be the fact that an envious person, which is by definition someone who feels or does not wish that any blessing or good things happen to you, doesn't want the good thing to remain with you, that you'll be taken away, that he or she may be driven by this kind of extreme jealousy to try and do certain actions that may eventually cause some harm to you. This is one possible meaning for that. But on the other hand, we should not try to approach the subject in a way that just trying to appear overly rational and forget the fact that in human history and the experience of many people, there have been many cases where this envious eye did actually result, not cause, result in some harm that has happened to those people. Not necessarily mountains dissipating or something like that, but there might be something of that sort. How do we explain it? We don't know. There is no text that I know of for sure in the Quran or Sunnah, for example, or the saying of Prophet Muhammad, which gives a clear explanation as to how this happened. Is it the kind of thing that emanates from the person that's unseen that might be causing this harm? We don't know, and I don't want to make any guess on that issue. But what the Quran, however, say is that we should not have over anxiety about this bad eye. The Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, has taught us to recite 3 times the last 3 chapters of the Quran. 2 of them, chapter 113 and 114, involve all kinds of invocation of the name of God for protection, that they should be mentioned or recited by the person at the time of sleeping, when he goes to bed, or he or she goes to bed. But after all, the person really should keep his trust in God, should not have this undue anxiety of any bad eye, anything that might happen to him, because everything is in the power of God.
Right. Well, we didn't have time in today's program to get into this next area that we want to touch on, and that relating to the questions relating to the Islamic belief in the soul and life in the hereafter. Unfortunately, we've exhausted our time for the day, but I invite all of the viewers of the Islam in Focus program back to our program next week, when we'll look at this question of the soul and life in the hereafter. That's our program for today. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you.
Allahu Akbar.